A stunning new novel set in 13th century Persia explores the spiritual path with an allegorical touch.
One of the things I wanted to portray was that the spiritual path is not a straight line. One finds and loses that path over and over and over, sometimes within a single day. And I think that when we understand that, we don't feel we've lost the way when we've lost the way. We just see, we've stumbled off and we have to find our way back.
That's Michael Golding. We talk with him about his beautifully written novel, A Poet of the Invisible World. Then, a different sort of allegorical novel entirely. Robin Cook's new medical thriller, Host.
Healthcare in this country exists for the benefit of the stakeholders, the hospital corporations, the health insurance companies, the pharmaceutical companies, the device makers, etc. They're the ones that are benefiting from this system so much more than we as the public. That's the reality, and that's what I'm trying to get people to understand through my fiction. The final message is, in Host, that we have a healthcare system that's taking advantage of us patients. We're all patients at some point.
That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and on the web at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. A baby born with 4 ears in 13th century Persia would have been regarded as something unholy, even demonic. Yet Nuri, the hero of Michael Golding's new novel, A Poet of the Invisible World, is both blessed and cursed, much as we all are as we make our way through our lives. Nuri is orphaned at the moment of his birth, a tragedy. Yet in the next moment, he literally drops from the sky into the arms of a gentle soul who takes him to be raised within the loving walls of a Sufi monastery. A blessing. On his hero's journey through life, Nuri is confronted with good and evil, acceptance and hatred, good fortune and bad. Through it all, he must find his own moral compass. This he does by following the lodestar of his poetic genius, as he becomes a poet of the invisible world. Author Michael Golding has a poetic genius of his own, as I discovered in the lyrical pages of his enchanting and evocative novel. He spins a terrific yarn, a kind of modern Arabian Nights, that has the power to both move and instruct the reader. Golding's previous novels are Simple Prayers and Benjamin's Gift. He teaches writing and literature at Yuba College in California. A Poet of the Invisible World is out from Picador Press. Well, Michael Golding, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you, Francesca. It's very nice to be here.
A Poet of the Invisible World. This is just such an enchanting story. A story of a life's journey, a life's spiritual journey, that takes place in the 13th century in the lands of the Caliphate. The central character is Nuri, who we meet at the moment of his birth. And he has a very unique characteristic that puts its stamp on his entire life. Tell us about Nuri and tell us about this characteristic of his.
Well, it's not spoiling anything to tell you because you find this out in the first sentence of the book. But Nuri is born with 4 ears. And that clearly marks him as unusual. But I think it also suggests that he has an unusual path to travel in this life. He is orphaned quite young, and he is taken in by a band of dervishes and enters the world of the Sufis.
Yeah, he's taken in by the Sufis. Now, first of all, for those of our listeners who may be a little vague on who the Sufis are, tell us about them.
The Sufis are what I suppose you could call the more esoteric part of Islam, of the Muslim faith. They have their own ways, and they take the words of the Prophet in a more inward way, in a more internal way. The poet Rumi, for example, was a Sufi, and a great deal of beautiful poetry has come out of that tradition.
Now, you have written a novel steeped in Sufism, in the spiritual tradition of Sufism, but you're Jewish. You were raised as a Jew. What attracts you to Sufism? Why did you choose this as the religion of your main character?
Well, from one point of view, I feel my characters choose me and the books choose me. I had a very clear sense of this world of the Sufis at the time of Rufi and Hafiz and Attar, the great poets, which is 12th, 13th, 14th century. And I just follow it when it comes that strongly. For myself, I was raised in the Jewish tradition, but over the years, I feel that I have found the truth in many different places, in all faiths. And I feel essentially the truth is the same. When you strip away the exterior, you find the same truth being taught. And so it's not that strange for me to be charting the spiritual growth of someone in the Muslim faith. The only thing is, I wanted to be very scrupulously careful to be truthful about it. So I had to learn quite a lot in order to do that. But with what's going on in the world today in terms of Islam, I wanted to understand more about the beauty of the culture and the wisdom of the culture, because I think we're cut off from that. And I think it's important that people see that just like Christianity or Judaism or Buddhism or Zoroastrianism, there's an incredible depth and beauty to it.
Do you have a spiritual practice yourself?
I do have a spiritual practice, yes. It's kind of hard to pinpoint what you would call it. I think it's founded in something called the Fourth Way, which is a practice based on the teachings of George Gurdjieff and Peter Uspensky, who were working and living at the beginning of the 20th century. And their work basically does delve into all teachings. Gurdjieff basically went on a path to try to find what the truth was, and he gathered it from many different places, and he tried to create a way of thinking about it that was freed from all the traditions that bog us down. And I find it an extremely invigorating and important way to work.
So let's go back to the book. You have Nuri, who is raised, as we said, in a Sufi brotherhood, and one of the monks, Sharoud, is a kind of nemesis figure. In fact, later in the book, he's given the name Brother Shadow. Who is Brother Shadow?
Brother Shadow is Sharoud. I mean, in many ways, it's as internal as it is external. I mean, from one point of view, there are people on the spiritual path. Well, actually, everyone on the spiritual path has to struggle with the lower part of him or herself as well as the higher. I mean, that is the path, and that's very much what Nuri has to go through. And Sharoud is someone who is having a hard time with that battle, and in many ways, the lower part of himself is taking over. And so on an external level, one could say that a being like Nuri has to deal with and encounter a being like Sharoud, who is a roadblock in many ways for his aspirations. But one can also take it internally. Someone once said that all the characters of a book are internal parts of one being, and we all have a Nuri inside, and we all have a Sharoud inside, and it's that battle that we're fighting, whether we know it or not, I believe.
Yes, and how did he come to you? I mean, you said that your characters come to you, you don't really invent them. What was your sense when this monk, this person who's dedicated himself to the esoteric life of Sufism, struggles so much with his own evil nature?
Well, I would say of all writers who have influenced me the most, I'm most influenced by Shakespeare. He's really a master for me. And one of the reasons I love Shakespeare so much is that he saw everything inside of himself. He saw Juliet and he saw Caliban. And he understood that they were all parts of his inner world. And his courage in seeing everything inside himself has given me a lot of courage in terms of my writing, I suppose in terms of my living as well. So I'm not surprised that there are Sherrods inside. They're probably much worse than Sherrods inside. And I think part of the writing process is to give space for those to come up so that one can see them, one can distance oneself from them more clearly and understand what they are and what they aren't. So in every writing project, from one point of view, all the characters are me, and they're all battling it out, just like they're battling it out inside of me.
It puts me almost in mind of Gestalt therapy or psychosynthesis, which also postulates, say, for example, in dreams, that every part of the dream is an aspect of oneself.
Right. And I'm sure that my writing is a form of self-therapy. I don't have any doubt about that.
And that's true also for your character, Nouri. And say more about him. What is his... Tell us about his internal process, who he is.
Well, I think one of the things I wanted to portray was that the spiritual path is not a straight line. One finds and loses that path over and over and over, sometimes within a single day. And I think that when we understand that, we don't feel we've lost the way when we've lost the way. We just see, we've stumbled off and we have to find our way back. I think that Nouri is a beautiful, pure soul. I love him, and I miss him. And I also think that he loses his way, and he forgets that he's a spiritual being. And he remembers, and then he forgets. And also, he has to go through a great deal of suffering, because I think suffering is what tempers the soul. And so, as his creator, I had to lovingly take him through that process and trust that he would keep finding his way forward, which is what we all have to do.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Michael Golding about his enchanting, his beautiful novel, A Poet of the Invisible World. Now, you just said something very interesting, which is that suffering tempers the soul. And it's certainly been my experience, but I've also often thought, does it have to be this way? What is it about suffering that tempers the soul?
Well, I don't know whether it has to be this way. I know it is this way. I mean, I think we live at a time when, because of technology and the internet, we're so aware of how much suffering is going on the planet, almost all the time. And I think we tend to feel it's worse now than it's ever been, but maybe we just weren't wired before in a way that we were aware of what was going on. So we know there's a lot of suffering on the planet. There's also a lot of joy, and I think it's very important to not forget that. But there is a lot of suffering. And what I personally experience is that when I am suffering, there isn't any space for what is false or frivolous or superficial. There isn't any space for what is self-involved and greedy and all of those things. We all have everything in us. And suffering somehow presses down on you in a way that you have to be very simple to get through it. And you also have to affirm your highest understandings to get through it. And I think that when the process has passed for the moment, then those understandings they belong to you more deeply because they've been imprinted on you. Gurdjieff said that suffering is a kind of fixative and it will make permanent what occurs while you're experiencing it. So if you curse and rail and complain and blame, that can become more permanent in you. And if you accept and you forgive and you trust, that can become more permanent in you because of the fire of suffering. I very much wanted to portray that in the novel.
And I think you did it really beautifully. Nuri, your main character, is an outcast because of his, I guess you could call it a deformity, although it hardly seems like one, the fact that he's got 4 ears.
Yes, it might be kind of interesting to look at. I've never met anybody with 4 ears, but I don't think of it as a kind of something aberrant. I just think of it as something we haven't seen before. Maybe in Star Trek or something you've seen it.
But he's also an outcast in another way, and that is because he falls in love with a man. I mean, I don't think they'd call it gay in 13th century Persia.
No, probably not. I don't think so.
But this is another way in which he struggles, and he is, you know, seen as something unclean by some of the people. Why did you make Nuri? Why did you make him gay? What were you trying to say in this novel? Or maybe there's no reason why shouldn't one have a gay character just as a matter of course.
Yes, I mean, I could say from one point of view, Nuri's gay because he's gay. It wasn't like when he was born and he popped out, I saw that he had 4 ears, but I didn't see that he was gay. I didn't find that out until he starts to go through his own sexual awakening, and that was what it was, and that was there. But I don't want to be coy and play any games. I as I said before, everything is within, and so clearly something in myself was being examined and worked out and explored in that process as well, and that's the way it is.
And was that something that opened new vistas to you?
I would say it's not that it's something I didn't know before. It's something that I don't feel I was always able to integrate in my life. And I think it's something that has produced a fair amount of conflict for me. And I think part of the book, writing the book, was to be done with that, to move through that, to integrate, to embrace, to allow. And I feel very much that that has occurred.
And also you said that through writing you work things out, but that's something very true for Nuri as well. Tell us about Nuri as a poet.
Yes. Well, you know, one of the seeds was I wasn't trying in any way to write about Rumi, but I would read Rumi and Attar and think, where did this gorgeous incandescent expression come from? It cannot come from a vacuum. It has to come from personal understanding, personal struggle. And so I wanted to figure that out. And so for Nuri, writing is an expression. He's clearly someone for whom words are the way to express. And I believe we all have something. Some people dance, some people cook, some people garden. I think everyone has a way of expressing their love, their joy, themselves. And for Nuri, it's words, and for me, it's words. So it was also a way to look at that, and what does that mean, and why does one write, and where does it come from, and how does it work, and what is happening during those periods when one is cut off from it, and when one reconnects to it, and as one grows and matures, and one cares less about the response to it as much as the experience of doing it.
Mm. And he's a poet of the invisible world.
Yes.
Say something about the invisible world. Why that?
Well, I think that the invisible world is there all the time. We just don't see it. And I think that part of our suffering is that we sometimes believe that only what we can see and hear and taste and touch and feel is real. And I don't believe that's true. I believe that many things exist. I think thoughts and emotions are invisible and they're real. But I also think there are higher worlds and higher planes of existence that are real. And I've had experiences where I was certain of that. And then I fall back down into normal life. And it seems like maybe I just imagined that. But I think that's not true. I think when we're not in touch with that, we have to know that we perceived something and it was true. And for me, the spiritual path is to make the invisible world, some people call it God, you don't have to call it God, but that actually becomes more real than the visible world. And it's a kind of a paradigm shift. And I think anyone on a spiritual path has tasted that and has had glimpses of that, and sometimes more than glimpses.
Yes, I think that's the point where, you know, the unity, they talk of the spiritual path, it talks of the unity of all things, whereas what we see in the world is how separate we are.
Right.
But are you willing to share with us perhaps one of those experiences that you were just speaking about?
I'm willing to, but I don't know that I can, because just as it is invisible, I think it's nonverbal. I think the best I could say, and again, I'm not being coy, I'm not trying to sell copies of the book, but I think the best I could do is in the moments in the book when Nori has an experience of a higher world, there's a particular moment in chapter 4 when he's 7, and he's old enough now that the head of the Sufi order, Sheikh Bailiri, begins to take him under his wing and teach him. He recognizes that Nuri is someone who's on the path. And he takes him to the mosque. And in the mosque, Nuri has an experience, a flash through the crashing of a lamp at his feet of that higher world. And he doesn't understand it, but he knows suddenly that there is something else there. And that's something I tried to portray in the book. I have had those kinds of experiences, but I don't know that it's any more telling for me to describe one of those than I think I did a better job describing that experience for Nori.
Mm-hmm. Now, another aspect of the spiritual journey is the twists and turns of fate. And he certainly goes through those.
Don't you experience them every day, Francesca?
Well, yeah, I don't know if I'd say every day, but they certainly come and smack me upside the head on a frequent basis.
Absolutely.
Could you talk about that in terms of this novel and how Nuri grows through them? After all, he becomes he's a devotee, he's a shepherd, a servant, a poet. He's brought up and cast down.
That's right, many times. I suppose that at this point in my life, I could say I'm a fatalist. I really do believe we have fate and that our fates unfold. And from one point of view, I'm not sure they're alterable. I think, again, this goes to the invisible world, because it's not so much what's happening that matters, it's how we are relating to it. We go up and down. Everybody knows the Wheel of Fortune goes up and down. And we have loss, and we have success, and we have joy, and we have sorrow. And we go from the top of the mountain to the pit. And from one point of view, it doesn't matter. What matters is how we are relating to it all along. And again, when we're down in the pit, we have to remember what's highest. And when we're at the top of the glory field, we have to remember something that makes us humble and simple and real. So there's a through line that has to always continue. And maybe that's what the vicissitudes of fate are for, is to, again, reinforce that part that is stable and strong and knows who it really is, which is invisible.
Yes, I've always thought that's the secret to happiness, is realizing that it's how you relate to things, not what happens.
Exactly.
Yeah. If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Michael Golding about his new novel, A Poet of the Invisible World. It's set among the Sufi Islamic world of the 13th century. Now, there's some other parts of the book. I mean, I think you must have done a whole lot of research, and part of the research is around food. You even have a glossary of food. Like, what's with that?
Well, I like food. I really, I mean, from one point of view, I like food. I like eating, but it's not as silly as that. I do believe that God is in the details, and I feel that if you're going to create not just the 13th century, but if you're going to create a fictional world that you are inviting a reader into, you want to create sensory details. You have to create sensory details that are very strong and specific. And so one of the ways to root the reader in a world that is foreign to him or her is to describe these wonderful meals and these things that they eat, because we all eat every day, and it's something relatable, and it's something, especially if you're writing a book that's about abstract, invisible world, the development of the soul, I mean, that's so kind of airy. Have them sit down and eat a stew with lamb and potatoes and coriander and whatever in it. It somehow that grounding gives you permission to take the flights when you need to take them.
This is really a classic kind of storytelling. It's almost like as beguiling as the Arabian Nights, you know, 1001 Arabian Nights. You really have a marvelous knack for that. And you said Shakespeare was your greatest influence in writing. And, of course, he told wonderful tales. But this is in a different kind of genre. Who in this kind of genre of the storytelling, I wouldn't say it's fantasy, I don't really know what to call it, but who else would have influenced you in this?
Well, there are certain 20th century writers whose work I would say includes magic and fable. There's a term, magic realism, but I'm not quite so sure if that category fits everyone. Certainly, Toni Morrison is an amazing magical writer. Gabriel Garcia Marquez is an amazing magical writer, and they just dynamite the rules, and things happen that maybe don't happen so much in the real world, but they seem real when they write about them. In Beloved, which is a book I think is quite brilliant, one of the characters doesn't have a navel. How is that any different from Nori having four ears? Mm-hmm. And what does that mean? And one could say what it means, but it's also wonderful to not say what it means. So there are so many wonderful writers out there writing great things.
Are you writing anything else? Are you working on anything else right now?
I am. I'm about 75 pages into a new book. I'm having a great time. It is very different from A Poet of the Invisible World. It's set in the mid-20th century, and I'm having a blast writing it. I'm not going to tell you too much about it yet. It's too early.
Well, don't tell me about it, but I do want to know about it when it's done, because I'd love to talk with you again.
Wonderful, Francesca. It's been a pleasure, and I look forward to you reading the new one when it comes out.
Michael Golding is the author of A Poet of the Invisible World. I recommend this novel to all my listeners. I want to thank you so much, Michael Golding, for talking with us here.
Thank you, Francesca.
Read an excerpt from Michael Golding's novel, A Poet of the Invisible World, at writersvoice.net. Next up, Robin Cook's new medical thriller, Host. Stick around. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Novelist and physician Robin Cook practically invented the medical thriller genre with his bestseller, Coma. After Coma, he went on to write 32 more novels exploring medical ethics and public policy issues, like genetic engineering, medical malpractice, and drug research. A common theme is the collision between the interests of patients and the financial interests of our $3 trillion American healthcare industry. Cook's latest novel, Host, tackles the next big thing in medicine, biologics. These are drugs created from living cells. They could be a game changer in cancer treatment. But with billions on the line, they also pose serious risks to patients, as well as temptations for morally challenged companies. Well, Robin Cook, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
You're a best-selling author of medical thrillers. Some credit you with practically inventing the genre with the hugely successful Coma. You're also a doctor. Why did you start writing medical thrillers?
Well, I started writing, fiction writing, because I thought that I had something to say. And why that was is because part of the reason that I got influence to go into medicine was because I had read a lot of books about medicine, Not as a Stranger, Arrowsmith, a number of books, and also had watched a number of TV shows back when I was in college. Every Thursday night we'd watch Dr. Ben Casey and Marcus Welby, and part of the reason I went into medicine was because I was really attracted to the portrayal of medicine in those books and shows, etc. And I wasn't there more than 2 or 3 months, and I said, you know, I'm entering a very different fraternity than what has been presented and in the media. And I said, you know, someday I'm going to rectify this, and I'm going to write a book about medicine the way it really is, with its warts, etc. And that was really what stimulated me with the idea of actually even writing a novel about medicine, just to make it based in reality rather than based in what people wanted to think.
And your latest really delves into, like all of them, these warts that are on our medical system are $3 trillion a year medical system. It's medicine developing technologically at warp speed these days. What are your biggest concerns about risks in medicine?
Well, the first one, of course, is the fact that hospitals are very dangerous places. They're places that are making enormous profits for the investors, and the hospital administrators. I mean, they're so overpaid. It's almost a cruel joke. And yet, the problem with what possibly can happen to a patient going into a hospital today is even worse than when I started writing. And it's something that's definitely known. I mean, it's close to 100,000 people die every year from an illness that they got in the hospital that's different from the illness that brought them into the hospital. But even beyond that, the fact that the hospital corporations, et cetera, are robbing the country blind, taking advantage of patients, taking advantage of the circumstance. We have a very unique healthcare system in this country. It's different from every other industrialized country where the healthcare system is some sort of, there's a kind of a rational approach to it based upon the fact that they believe that healthcare is a right of a citizen. It means that it's a major role of government. And we're the only industrialized country that doesn't believe that. And in fact, healthcare in this country exists for the benefit of the stakeholders, the hospital corporations, insurance companies, health insurance companies, the pharmaceutical companies, the device makers, the health, the medical lab companies, etc. They're the ones that are benefiting from this system so much more than we as the public. That's the reality, and that's what I'm trying to get people to understand through my fiction.
And all those issues are taken up in your new book. But before we get to that new book, I just want to ask you, I mean, you're still a practicing doctor, is that correct?
Well, I don't have a private practice any longer. Luckily, because then I don't have to deal with the health insurance companies, which has become a nightmare for doctors. In fact, most doctors of my generation are retiring. And when we all decided to go into medicine, one of the reasons we went in, because all our mentors, our doctor mentors, nobody ever retired. They just dropped in their tracks doing what they love to do. But it's an indication that the doctors have been alienated in our current system, as well as the patients. And isn't that curious? Because the doctors and patients who should be at the center of healthcare are the two groups that are alienated from the healthcare industry.
That's a very telling comment. If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Robin Cook about his newest medical thriller, Host. Now, your latest, Host, tells the story of a fourth-year medical student, Lynn, her fiancé, who suffers a devastating outcome after routine surgery, and her best friend, Michael, who's another medical student, who she enlists in trying to find out what happened to her fiancé. Tell us what did happen to Carl in the first chapters of the book. Obviously, I don't want to give away the denouement of the book because this is a thriller. But tell us the broad outlines of the story.
Well, the broad outlines is this very healthy young lawyer who's the boyfriend and soon-to-be fiancé, as she learns during the course of the story, of one of the main characters. And I'm glad that you mentioned that there are two main characters, which makes this a little bit unique even in that, because of that. Usually you have a main character in a mystery thriller. This one has two. This boyfriend goes in for routine knee surgery and ends up a vegetable. Never recovers from anesthesia. And this, of course, is terrible news to our main character, Lynn. But being a medical student, and she's not paralyzed by the grief. She's actually motivated by the grief. She has to find out what happened. Why did... And her first thought is that somebody screwed up and somebody's covering it up. And she doesn't think that that's right. But it's worse than that, what she and her former lab partner... What happens when you go to medical school, you usually get teamed up with somebody. And it's usually somebody alphabetically close to you. So when I was in medical school, my name was Cook. I got teamed up with Stephen Corey. you do all sorts of things with your partner in terms of labs and learning to stick, learning to draw blood and whatnot. And sometimes these friendships really can be very strong. And indeed, the one in Host is extremely strong.
They both come from, less advantaged economic backgrounds, Lynn and Michael. And Lynn is white, Michael is black. Why did you decide to give them these kinds of backgrounds?
Well, when you develop the kind of personalities that you want to make your story go forward, you have to develop certain characteristics that make it seem reasonable that these people are doing what they're doing. And therefore, they're usually, it's part heredity, part nurture, et cetera. So you have to tailor the background as well to try to create a very realistic circumstance. At least I do. And I'm very interested in psychology and psychiatry, et cetera. In fact, I toyed with the idea of taking a third residency in psychiatry just because of interest in, but I realized I didn't want to be a psychiatrist, so that was kind of a bummer. But nonetheless, I created this, and it's interesting that you mention because the fact that one of them is black, and the reason I think it's interesting is, first of all, I populate my books with all sorts of medical issues. Coma, which I wrote a long time ago, I made the main character a woman very specifically then because I felt personally that we should have more women in medicine. When I was in medical school, we had six female medical students in my class, and I felt that it should be very different. And that was one of the reasons I made the main character in Coma a woman, and I did indeed get a lot of letters from women who went into medicine and said that they went into medicine because they read Coma when they were in high school and decided they wanted to go into medicine. I have a very similar feeling now is because we don't have enough black male physicians. In fact, the number of male physician, black male physicians is going down even with the active recruiting process. So I thought, well, let's add that as well. And it's also sort of fun that the way I bring it in, I don't know if you noticed, but the way this character is introduced, you don't know he's black until about page 60. And it's interesting because it plays a little bit on stereotypes and makes the reader realize or surprised because they've already made some sort of decision from stereotypes, and which always reminded me of the joke. There's a joke, it's a riddle, and you can't figure it out until you realize that the surgeon was a woman and yet your stereotype is a surgeon as a man. But anyway, those are all the some of the background of why I created this pair as I did. And I also created it as a pair because I wrote this as a screenplay first. And it's much easier to have people, you have to bring everything out in dialogue in a screenplay, whereas in a novel form, if you have a single protagonist, you use the benefit of the third person. You can say what the person is thinking. Can't do that in a screenplay. They have to tell each other. And so that's why I did that. Because I really am gearing Host to also be a movie.
Like so many others of your books have become movies.
Yeah, well, I did, but then I got down on regular theatrical movies a little bit because I lost control and got fired on a number of projects, and then they proceeded to distort my storyline to what they thought was appropriate and I thought was inappropriate. No, part of the problem is that I don't write horror books. There are horrific elements of my books because that's what medicine really is like. I mean, what does it deal with? Death and disease. And so there's horrific elements to it. But they're not horror stories per se. And I don't want that distortion because I think it blurs the final message. The final message is, in Host, that we have a healthcare system that's taking advantage of us patients. We're all patients at some point. So that's the message, and I don't want it distorted.
Right, and I'd love to get back to that point in a minute. But first, a little bit more about this book. It introduced something to me that I had never heard of, and that is biologic drugs. You know, tell us what these are. Are these the coming thing?
These definitely are the coming thing, and they do have a lot of promise. And why they're called biologics versus just drugs is because drugs are made by chemistry. You know, you put this molecule with this molecule and this element and stick it on here and a chain there and whatever. It's done by chemistry. Biologics are different. Biologics are drugs that are derived from living systems. In other words, it's not a factory that's making this. It's actually a living system. They're live cells. And what biologics are, to a large degree, are antibodies. And antibodies are proteins that living systems make to combat problems, either infectious problems or problems with proteins or cells that are out of whack. For instance, cancer. Cancer is a situation where cells are out of whack. They're not responding to the normal restrictions, and usually these cells have different proteins on their surface. And it's felt that our immune system handles potential cancerous cells on a regular basis in our bodies. And so it has a lot of promise in terms of being able to cure cancers. So these are a new class of drugs. They're made by living systems, and the systems are generally mouse cells. And they use mouse cells to make antibodies. They challenge the mouse cell with an antigen, it's called, and it's a protein that you want to make an antibody for that will eliminate that protein, and you get the cell to do it, and then you transform the cell into a cancer cell. It sounds like fiction, but it's not. It's real. This is what happens. This is where they come from. And they always have long names that are almost impossible to pronounce, but they all end in AB, A-B, and that's for antibody.
Oh, I think I have heard of some of them. Well, what's the downside? I mean, it seems to me in every new medical advance, there are also risks. What are some of the risks with biologics?
Well, the risks are, since they're made by mouse cells, they tend to have mouse proteins. And you know, if you put a foreign protein into the human body, that often it can then stimulate the formation of antibodies to the drug. Well, you don't want that to happen, because obviously then the drug's not going to work, because if there's no antibodies, it's going to get rid of the drug. So you have to trick the immune system by making the mouse antibody seem like a human antibody. And you can do that, and there's various tricks, but each one requires certain steps and effort and money, et cetera, and it's still not absolutely perfect. Some are better than others, and there are sort of other ways of putting in human genes into the mouse cells to make these better and all that sort of stuff. But it would be much better to use human cells to make human antibodies. I mean, that's obvious. And if you look at the title of host, where did this come from? Has something to do with a dinner party? No. It's the medical meaning of host. And the medical meaning of host is in reference to like a parasitic disease. A parasite is in a host. The host is the one that's supporting the parasite and being kind of taken advantage of. And that's what's going on in this book, in that sense, that we, the patients, are being taken advantage of.
Is this far-fetched?
No. In fact, almost all of my books come to pass. Within last year's book, Cell, I thought it was going to take 4 or 5 years for Cell to what I prophesied in Cell, in the sense that the cell phone was going to become a medical device. It's already happening. There's 100,000 apps, medical apps already. And no, this is not far-fetched. I think that where do we get blood from? We get blood from people who donate it. But that's one way to do it. I mean, we could get blood from people who didn't know they were being bled for their blood as well. And in a certain sense, that's what's happening here, is that people are being turned into miniature biologic factories, and they don't even know it. So it's another way that the healthcare system is taking advantage of us in terms of the hospital chains and pharmaceutical companies.
And it's a chilling way that it's done as well in this book, Host. You know, there's been a lot in the news about Planned Parenthood and embryos and fetal cells. Does that come in here as well? I mean, could there be hosts that are more benign through the use of embryonic tissue?
Well, you know, that's an issue that I've dealt with within quite a few of my books in the past. The whole stem cell embryonic circumstance. And this book doesn't. This book is really more of the fact that the pharmaceutical industry and the hospital industry are really out for their own profit. That's their main goal.
And you bring in a criminal element as well. I mean, not that the activity is not criminal, that is already goes on, you know, so-called legally in some ways. But in this case, you bring in a Russian oligarch. Is this also something that we should be concerned about, that is the involvement of criminal networks with drug research and medicine?
The medical industrial complex of the United States, which is now approaching $3 trillion a year, is going to attract those elements that are interested in big profits. And this is the biggest profit. Healthcare is the biggest single industry in the United States. It's four times the size of the military industrial complex. I don't know if you remember, but in the 50s and the 60s, there was a great concern that the military industrial complex was getting too big and too powerful. Well, that didn't really happen. But what's happened is the medical industrial complex has so passed. They outspend the military industrial complex four times in terms of lobbying politicians. The pharmaceutical industry alone spends in 2014 spent $240 million lobbying Washington politicians. That's approaching $1 million a day. No wonder we have such screwy laws in this country to the benefit of the pharmaceutical industry.
What do you feel should be done about this? I mean, we had a major health insurance reform, that's Obamacare. Bernie Sanders and others have called for Medicare for All. What do you think is the solution?
Medicare for All is something that we will have to go to eventually. It's the only thing that makes sense. Obamacare, it talks about being health insurance reform. There have been some reform in the sense that prior to Obamacare, health insurance companies were happy to sell you products that were so inadequate that it was a joke. If something really did happen, you were not covered in any reasonable fashion. And it did get rid of that kind of plan, those products. But actually, Obamacare is not really reform in any other sense other than trying to get some of the 50 million people that had no health insurance into the system. The problem, of course, is that by bringing potentially up to 50 million people into a system that was already broken just means that it's going to cause that much more problems and also going to result in that much more profit for the stakeholders in the industry. No wonder they were not against it. They had to cough up a little bit, but the benefits that they're reaping are so far beyond anything that they had to kind of compromise on initially to get it passed.
Well, we've heard it from the horse's mouth, I'd say, a doctor and a best-selling medical thriller author, that Medicare for All is something we have to go toward. Robin Cook, I want to thank you so much for talking with us here about Host, your latest novel. It's really terrific. Thanks again for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Robin Cook. You can read an excerpt from his new novel, Host, at writersvoice.net. In the first segment of today's show, we heard Michael Golding talk about his book, his novel, A Poet of the Invisible World. It's set in 13th century Persia, with a Sufi theme. I thought, in the time that we have left, it would be nice to read some of my favorite poems of the Sufi poet Rumi. These are from the book The Illuminated Rumi, with translations and commentary by Coleman Barks. Keep walking, though there's no place to get to. Don't try to see through the distances. That's not for human beings. Move within, but don't move the way fear makes you move. Today, like every other day, we wake up empty and frightened. Don't open the door to the study and begin reading. Take down a musical instrument. Let the beauty we love be what we do. There are hundreds of ways to kneel and kiss the ground. Here's another. That hurt we embrace becomes joy. Call it to your arms where it can change. A silkworm eating leaves makes a cocoon. Each of us weaves a chamber of leaves and sticks. Like silkworms, we begin to exist as we disappear inside that room. Without legs, we fly. When I stop speaking, this poem will close in silence more magnificent. I don't regret how much I love, and I avoid those who repent their passion. Hundreds of sweethearts. I am the lover and the one lovers long for. Blue and a cure for blues. Sky in a small cage, badly hurt but flying. Everyone's scandalous flaw is mine. Not Christian or Jew or Muslim, not Hindu, Buddhist, Sufi or Zen, not any religion or cultural system, I am not from the East or the West, not out of the ocean or up from the ground, not natural or ethereal, not composed of elements at all, I do not exist, am not an entity in this world or the next. Did not descend from Adam and Eve or any origin story. My place is the placeless, a trace of the traceless, neither body nor soul. I belong to the beloved, having seen the two worlds as one and that one call to and know. First, last, outer, inner, only that breath breathing, human being. I'm not sure that one is by Rumi or a commentary in poetry by Coleman Brooks. I'm reading poems by Rumi from the book The Illuminated Rumi. And here's a final one. I think it's my favorite. Out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing, there is a field. I'll meet you there. When the soul lies down in that grass, the world is too full to talk about. Ideas, language, even the phrase each other doesn't make any sense. So those are readings from The Illuminated Rumi, translations and commentary by Coleman Barks, illuminations by Michael Green. It's out from Broadway Press. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows. Plus, find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.